Servus, grüß Gott, hochhandet, otsihilijang, welcome folks from around the planet. This is Chris live in central Pennsylvania with my special guest today, Martin von Staden, who is with the Free Market Foundation. We met briefly in person, hopefully he recalls, that was at Ernst von Sales' film debut for his documentary Selbstbestuur. Martin, hochhandet.
Gaan baie goed, dankie. It's going very well. Thank you, Chris. Thanks for having me on the show.
No, it's my pleasure. You know, we linked up there very quickly, and I got details from you and a few other folks that I really was curious to interview, and I don't recall where those details are. They're somewhere here in my studio. But in the meantime, this employment, and obviously I'll show my bias or my analysis on it, this Employment Inequality Act amendment, which is something that you've been studying for some time. Now we're going to get into that. But I contacted David Ansara, a mutual friend who's also at the Free Market Foundation, to see if he wanted to talk about this. And he said, sure. And then he said, you know what? It's probably a better fit to get Martin von Staden to do this. I'm like, okay, cool. Can you give me his deets? Anyway, so that's how we got here. So Martin, welcome to the program. First time on, and it's a pleasure to have you.
Yeah, no, really. Thank you for having me. It's very important to be able to talk about these pernicious measures that the South African government keeps throwing at the economy and at society. So thank you for the opportunity.
Well, you're very welcome. It's what's really sad about this is that these idiotic racial laws harm all South Africans, especially Black South Africans. They dissuade foreign direct investment. I know I'm not putting my money in South Africa if I have to hand it over to somebody based on the mere fact that by good or bad fortune, they wound up with different skin pigmentation. I mean, that seems pretty crazy. But before we get into that, you are in a role now at the Free Market Foundation, I believe, as a head of policy. If I got it correct, let me know. And when did you start there? And what exactly does that mean? Because I'm sure people have no idea what that means. And maybe tell us a little bit about the Free Market Foundation, because it might be the first time many of my viewers from around the world have heard of it.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I've been with the FMF on and off for many years. I started here full time in 2017 as a legal researcher, and I went on to become its head of legal policy. And then I went to other organizations, which I'm sure you're familiar with, SAKLIGA, and most recently, the Institute of Race Relations, one of South Africa's oldest classical liberal think tanks. Now, the FMF itself, I returned to the FMF very recently, the 1st of June, as its head of policy. So this is my first week back in the office. The FMF has a proud history, a long history. It was founded in 1975, very much in response to apartheid's racial and social engineering. The government going into the economy and telling people, listen, you can't take this job because you're Black and this is reserved for white people, or Indian can't take this job because it's reserved for coloreds, and certain people of certain races couldn't live in certain areas. The FMF was very much founded during the height of that era to say, listen, you as the apartheid government, you claim to be an outpost of Western civilization in Africa, and how dare you claim that when you are implementing almost Leninist type socialism in this country. We as the Free Market Foundation believe in real capitalism and individual freedom and rule of law and constitutionalism. And that's a fight that the FMF fought for the rest of apartheid, and played an important role during the transition out of apartheid into democracy, what we hoped would be a liberal, free democracy, adopting a supreme constitution that in its text says it is a non-racial constitution. And the FMF has existed since then up to now, continuing the good fight for sensible public policy that is based in evidence, but also that respects the principles of markets, of economics, and respects the individual to do as they please without some know-it-all politician trying to dictate that to them. And as head of policy, it's kind of falls to me in the foundation to look at the South African landscape, what is happening in the policy front, to determine with my colleagues what the FMF is going to say about that, and to ultimately advocate that very publicly, very directly in the public sphere, and ensure that South Africans start understanding that there is actually a better way to live and to prosper, and that is through free enterprise, through individual liberty, and through limited, severely limited government power.
Well, it sounds like it's similar in some respects to the Mises Institute, its focus on free markets. And I think that probably inspiration for an organization like this probably came from the likes of Adam Smith, David Ricardo, and those sort of folks, yes?
Yes, yeah, we are very much in the Mises Institute's Austrian economics fold. But when the FMF was founded, I think around the world, there was only the Foundation for Economic Education, known as FEE, in the United States. There was the IEA in the UK, the Institute of Economic Affairs, and the Atlas Research Foundation, which is still around today. So it was a very small club back then. Thankfully, now we have things like Mises, we have the Cato Institute, we have the Heritage Foundation, et cetera, all very much around the world dedicated to a single fight for freedom. And yes, very much in that Austrian mold. Certainly Adam Smith is there, but we kind of draw inspiration more directly from individuals like Ludwig von Mises, Friedrich von Hayek. In South Africa itself, we had William Hutt, we had Ludwig Lachmann. So it's a very proud tradition, and we're very proud to carry that message forth here in what can only be described as a very unwelcoming African context.
Yeah, no doubt about that. One of the absolute best treatises ever written, Friedrich Hayek's Road to Serfdom. Couldn't come up with a better title than that to explain the march of the lunacy around the world, which is at high tide at the moment everywhere, including right here, of all places, the United States. Canada's gone, New Zealand, Australia, UK. It's a disaster, but people are fighting the good fight. Now, I should make it clear for my U.S. audience, because the words get mixed up and jumbled up. So, for instance, if you're talking about German politics, you talk about the FDP, they call them the Liberal Party. They're not actually a liberal party. They're conservative, not liberal, but they're called the Liberal Party. Here in America, the term liberal is taken on a very bad connotation. I don't really attack liberals as such. I attack leftists. And pardon the language, but I call them hate-wanking leftists for the most part, these diabolical people on the far left. Whereas the term liberal, classical liberal, I'm a conservative politically in American context. But I'm a classical liberal when it comes to free markets and it comes to human rights and to free speech and freedom of assembly. I mean, those things get very much confused in today's world where so many people are, I would argue, Martin, are here and there and around the world are politically illiterate. They don't understand these things. And those who run the world in the media and social media and big tech and all that can so easily deceive and hoodwink people into disliking a group based on something they say. Do you think that's a fair assessment of where we sit today?
Yeah, I think so. So, I mean, in the FMF describes itself as a classical liberal institution. My previous employer, the Institute of Race Relations, is probably the oldest continuously existing classically liberal institution in the world. It was founded in 1929. Yes, we are all, and I very much lean into the term liberals, in the very traditional sense of that word being the philosophy of liberty, of freedom. The individual must be, and rightly is born free, and must be respected in that freedom. And yes, unfortunately, from the turn of the previous century up to the middle of the previous century, a few very influential American politicians put a lot of work into taking that very precious word liberal and twisting it into meaning something else. And that has kind of bled into Europe, and it's kind of bled into South Africa as well to an extent, where many people still say, oh, but I am a liberal. I believe in generosity and compassion. But ultimately, they're saying they're authoritarian, totalitarian, even social engineers. So there's lots of liberals who would say, no, we need employment equity in South Africa, given the history, which is very disturbing when you utilize past government wrongful government conduct to justify contemporary government overreach into people's personal lives, and then still call yourself a liberal. That's disgusting, and you're totally right. When we twist and then use sophistry in this way to twist political concepts and words, we always end up empowering a very small political elite that always wants to use that social manipulation to control people's lives from cradle to grave, ultimately.
Well, listen, for my audience, I have to give you, it's a big word alert day. I haven't done that in a while. I've been not using big words, but Martin's already said promiscuous and sophistry. Two big words, so big word alert there for those who are exercising your brains today in English. but I mentioned the liberal thing because I don't want my U.S. audience to disappear because that's a dirty word on this side of the Atlantic because of the context it's been misused in. But you've already started to, excuse me, I got a bit of a scratch here. You've already started to delve into today's topic here. And so let me get this straight before we get to the Employment Act. So what you're saying is that during the apartheid era, the National Party government excluded people from employment, from government positions, from government tenders, from university admissions, from fields of practice, like some fields of medicine and such, simply based on the pigmentation of their skin. Did I get that correct?
Yeah. Yes, so, absolutely.
Yeah. And in 2023, the African National Congress does the same damn thing.
Yes, no, it does. And I mean, it's I must disclaim, of course, because I hate hysterics and so on. The laws of the apartheid regime were certainly worse than the racial laws that we have today. Mm-hmm. No doubt about that.
Well, so yeah, the anti-miscegenation law, you can't even have a relationship with a person. Yeah, they were inhumane. Yeah. Yes, no doubt about it.
The apartheid government was the added benefit, like disadvantage there was that the apartheid government was very competent. It was very it pains me to use the word ethical, but the apartheid government didn't steal or tax resources and reuse that money very effectively to implement what was in effect a totalitarian racial system. And that's bad. I take heart and I'm very happy that the African National Congress government is very corrupt and very incompetent, because that kind of slows it down in implementing the full extent of the policies that it prefers. But yes, so the apartheid government had absolutely evil, terrible laws. And now in the name of balancing the
scales.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It's redress. It's the terminology of reparations and so on. The current government has also adopted race laws, and somehow this is okay. Now I have a little pet peeve when it comes to people judging laws based on their intentions rather than the nature of the law and the consequences of the law. Yes, because look, the apartheid government had good intentions. I mean, we should not be under any misgivings about that. The Hendrik Verwoerd and D.F. Malan, the people who implemented apartheid, didn't get together around the table and say, hey, we're really going to get the blacks now. That never happened. That conversation never occurred. Now, of course, they were trying to protect their constituency, which was the white electorate. But in doing that, they did not set out to harm black South Africans. They told themselves, and if they had good economic advisors like Friedrich von Hayek and Milton Friedman, they would have told them, listen, what you're doing is gonna have terrible consequences. But they didn't have good economic advisors. Their economic advisors told them, it's perfectly possible to take a group of people and put them somewhere and to try and create opportunities for them there, and then they will leave you alone. That is what apartheid effectively was. It was saying, we're going to separate white and black because these are two culturally different peoples. We want to protect the white civilization in South Africa first and foremost, but we also want to protect black civilization. We don't want the white man's religion and culture to harm the Zulu and the Khoisa culture.
Well, in fact, as you mentioned, the two groups there, Martin, in fact, it wasn't just white and black. It was also black and black. I mean, we had Mobutu Tswana, we had cis guy, trans guy, Venda, all these different based on relations and groups. It wasn't like there was like, this is for black folks. It was, this is for Zulu. And this is for the Khoisa and so on and so forth.
It was, yeah. And ultimately what the intention was good. I think it was very misguided, but the intention was pure. It was to ensure people lived freely in their own domains and their own spheres. Now, you cannot now say, okay, but apartheid's intentions were good, therefore we cannot criticize. That's ridiculous. Because
it has to be criticized. Devastating and life-altering consequences for millions of people.
Yes, and I mean, even aside from the consequences, the point is it was racial law. And if you look at the nature of law, what is it we understand by law? If you look at the common law, the English common law that the United States and South Africa share in, if you look at European continental common law, even if you look at Muslim common law, at African common law, there is no real concept of race. There are rules that bind the people.
Yep.
The law is binding on people. Now, what apartheid did was it introduced racial categories. There are a people, but we are going to treat different people who look differently in a different way. Now, that was in itself, regardless of consequence, even if it had perfect consequences, that is terrible. That is not something you want in law.
That is morally bankrupt.
Exactly. And that is why today, sitting here in 2023, when people say, no, but we have to allow something like the Employment Equity Act because it has a good intention. Apartheid was evil. We need to undo that. It's a good intention. Therefore, employment equity must be implemented. No, you cannot justify a law based on intentions. You have to look at the consequences. And what we've seen over the last 20 years when the Employment Equity Act has already existed, it's now just ramping up, but it's already existed. It has, at best, it has helped absolutely nobody. And at worst, it has created and contributed to increasing unemployment, increasingly low growth, alongside the hundreds of other race laws that South Africa has adopted. So we can judge it by its consequences and say the Employment Equity Act has been bad. But also, it is race law, and we do not want race in law because that is perverse. It is evil. So that's my pet peeve. People in South Africa, in the discourse, and unfortunately, even some foreigners who think, oh, but the only thing I know about South Africa is that a small group of whites came there and oppressed a large group of blacks. Of course, the blacks must set it right by adopting more race law. That, no, you cannot judge laws based on good intentions, because then the Nazis, the apartheid government, the Stalinist Russia, Pol Pot, all of them are paragons of absolute virtue, because all of them had in their own hearts pure intentions.
Yeah.
And the moment you make that concession, as an analyst and as a political observer, you enter the realm of total uselessness. You have to judge things by their nature, according to principle, and by their consequences. And that's not happening in South Africa. And it should, because then we'll all realize that what we're doing with these race laws remains just as evil today, if not certainly not as destructive, but just as evil as it was 50 years ago.
In fact, I would say not in the outcomes, but certainly it's more evil from the standpoint that one of the reasons we have such a unique political system in America is we have set a system up that in principle, in practice, with a lot of shenanigans going on, it's not the case. But in principle, our system protects the minority from oppression by a majority. And that is the worst and most promiscuous sort of discrimination and abuse, is a majority imposing on a minority. And we see that for conflict all over the world, whether it's in Spain with the Basque, or you take your pick, go around the planet. This is a majority oppressing a minority. Now, here's the thing that let's say I buy into it. I'm in the modern liberal sense, not the classical liberal sense. Okay, all right, you know what? I agree. Apartheid was terrible. We should get whitey. It's time to get even. So there's a problem with that. And that problem is a very simple one. The majority of South Africans were born after the African National Congress took power. They've had unchallenged power since 1994. With the exception of one election cycle, they've had a two-thirds majority the entire time to amend the Constitution anytime. They could have changed the Constitution, which they wrote, which they promulgated, which they approved and implemented. They could have done something with it. They have been in charge for the entire lifespan of the majority of South Africans. Blaming Jan van Riebeck, or blaming, you know, Shaka Zulu, or blaming Piet Retief is ludicrous. This government today, this society today, is a consequence of three decades of ANC rule and misrule. And I don't know how anyone can ever see that any other way.
Yeah. No, look, it's one of the uphill battles that we have to fight here, because it's true, certainly, that the consequences of apartheid are still with us. Sure, that's there for everyone to see. However, they need not have been with us if the ANC government had adopted sensible free market-based policies in 1994. The consequences of apartheid are still with us and have been exacerbated because of policy decisions made after 1994. And that is the key thing that people need to notice. At some point, the current circumstances must be blamed on decisions made after 1994 rather than beforehand. Even if we recognize in the abstract that the ball got rolling during the apartheid era, that like the snowball started rolling there. Of course, there is no debate on that. Even the most, let's call them right-wing white organizations in South Africa that are notable. There are one or two small fringe white supremacist groups that consist of no more than five people. But then there are what you call, what you could say are right-wing white organizations. They are not pro-apartheid organizations anymore. Even they recognize the inhumanity of what the apartheid system does. And their only difference with your garden variety liberal in South Africa is that they think white people still kind of have a right to exist. that's kind of the extent of their whiteness. So they understand apartheid was bad. So there's no debate about that. There is a class of commentators in South Africa and around the world who try to create this idea that people like me, people like the Institute of Race Relations, the EFMF, that we are saying no, apartheid wasn't that bad, and that we just want white people to prosper at the expense of blacks. That is not what anyone has ever said in the last three decades. No one has said that. Apartheid was bad, but what we are experiencing today cannot continuously and permanently be blamed on pre-1994, because we see in front of our eyes, we see it in the data, we see it playing out all around us, that policy decisions taken after 1994 and taken as recently as last week and last month are having actively detrimental effects in South Africa today on the poorest of the poor, on Black South Africans. White and wealthy South Africans still have that room to maneuver, that room to kind of insulate themselves from the horrifying consequences of bad policy decisions. Poor and Black South Africans have very little of that, and they are still and will probably for at least the next few decades remain the biggest disadvantaged group by contemporary policy. And that is the important thing to understand. Socialism does not work for the poor. It might sell itself as working for the poor, but it has never anywhere helped the poor in any way whatsoever. It has always schneid the poor first and foremost. And that is why when you look throughout history, you look at East and West Germany, you look at North and South Korea, you look at Colombia and Venezuela, you look at Zimbabwe and South Africa. The poor are always fleeing from the more socialist state to the freer state, from Zimbabwe to South Africa, from Venezuela to Colombia, from East to West Germany, from North to South Korea. People never flee in the other direction, never, ever. And at some point, South Africans are going to start fleeing out of South Africa to Botswana. They're going to start fleeing.
Well, that's already started to happen. I helped somebody do that 3 years ago.
Yes. No, it's certainly happening. And then we're going to see it more and more as this government doubles down on social engineering and on economic engineering, which I really at this stage hope that they, at least in the back of their minds, know cannot work. It has never worked and it will not work this time. And it will only cause more economic devastation.
So I need to address something in the chat here really quickly. Someone named Shroikun is saying ANC is not socialist. Let's be honest, social programs are not socialism. That is correct. Social programs are not socialism, but state control of industry, state control of events, state rules on what the private sector can do that impinge on free markets is socialism. And that's what we're talking about here. Correct, Martin?
Yes. Yeah. So the ANC, you could say that it has quite a big social democratic faction. But at least since the Jacob Zuma era, what is called here the Radical Economic Transformation Faction, RET, has gained an upper hand in South Africa. And some people say that since Cyril Ramaphosa got into power, that faction has kind of lost influence. But if you ask me, the RET faction is still the faction that's in power. And this is the faction that says we need to nationalize the Reserve Bank. It's basically already nationalized, but they want to like outright nationalize it. These are the people who say we have to confiscate private property without paying a cent in compensation.
Yeah, that's not capitalism.
that's clearly socialism. And it is also the people, the ANC, social democratic Mandela and Mbeki eras, they nationalized water in 1998. They nationalized privately owned water in 1998. That is outright socialism. And they nationalized minerals and petroleum in, I think it's 2002. Yep. That was in the midst of the Mbeki presidency. And Mbeki was by the standards that we have today, was a a free enterprise capitalist president, but this guy's government nationalized minerals and petroleum in South Africa.
Yep.
The ANC is certainly, it's certainly on the left, and I would say not on the center left, it's certainly on the left wing, and it comes very close to being far left, because it is very friendly with South Africa's Communist Party. It is in a
Every single senior member and every member of the National Executive Committee is a card-carrying communist. They're a member of the South African Communist Party. If it wasn't for ANC membership, the South African Communist Party would collapse.
The SACP contested a election in its own name, I think a few years ago, but like a by-election somewhere in a corner, somewhere in South Africa. And it obviously didn't get any seats or anything. Like, so ordinary South Africans are not socialists. These are hardworking people. Black South Africans, these are hardworking people who really just want to get out of poverty. Socialism does not get people out of poverty. These people want to work themselves out of poverty, and this government is not giving them even a remote chance of doing that, with minimum wage laws, with some of the most restrictive
tourism relief
laws.
Fund.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and the corruption. I mean, stealing billions and trillions in taxpayer revenue that's supposed to fund these social services. I mean, yeah, look, it's the ANC is socialist. I mean, we can squibble about the theory underlying it, but nationalizing water, nationalizing minerals, wanting to expropriate property without any compensation, wanting to nationalize the Reserve Bank. And I mean, look, if you give me some time, I can present you a very long list of things that make the ANC very comfortably socialist.
Absolutely. Hey, folks, you're listening to Chris White Reports of the Indaba Africa Conversation. My guest today is Martin van Staden, the head of policy at the Free Market Foundation, formerly with the Institute for Race Relations, and has been working and looking into the Employment Equity Act, which I call the Inequity Act, but that's another story. We'll get more into that. But Martin, I want to go back to the point we talked about a few minutes ago. And, you know, this blaming the consequence of apartheid, yes, there will be lingering consequences. But South Africa today has lingering consequences, the Mfukane. It has lingering consequences of the six border wars between the Xhosa and the Boers. It has lingering consequences of the Bantu Nguni-speaking peoples crossing the Zambezi River 1600 years ago and the Limpopo River 1400 years ago, and then pushing the Khoi and San aside, or wiping them out in many cases, like in Zimbabwe, chasing them in the Kalahari. You know, people think of this, people live in this fantasy world. Oh, the San, they just love the Kalahari. That's why they're there. No, they were pushed into the Kalahari by Bantu-speaking peoples, by the Nguni-speaking peoples. And that's why they live in the Kalahari. And that's not a nice place to live. And maybe in the 21st century, you know, where you've got aircon and you're driving around a BMW. But, you know, up until recently, it was a pretty unpleasant place to live, chasing around, you know, shooting a springbok with a poison dart and chasing after him for 5 kilometers till he drops to get your dinner and then walk back with it. Well, my point here is that there are consequences in South Africa's history to its entire history, all of which linger into the present. There were no Zulu before Shaka. That didn't exist as a group. They created the Zulu. They created the Zulu Empire and expanded by absorbing or wiping out their neighbors and then raiding on them. So this nonsense going back and blaming consequences of apartheid, at some point that loses all of its currency. But we have to admit there are still lingering effects, but there are lingering effects, everything I just said.
Yeah. Yeah. The sad part of that is that there are solutions to the consequences of bad things that happen in history. As you rightly say, yes, history is replete with bad things, conquest, genocide, mass dispossession of property. This is something that whites did, colonialists did in South Africa. There's something that Bantu did in South Africa. These things really happened, and I feel comfortable in 2023 saying what those people did was wrong. In the context of their day and age, sure, you could make an argument and say, well, it was normal then. But I think we should be free to say that was wrong, and we don't want that anymore. But that is the point. We need to not want that anymore. We need to make a break with the past. Because if the moment you get stuck into this this cycle of saying, well, look, something bad happened in the past, so we're going to have to do something bad again to make that right. This is a cycle that that repeats itself always, indefinitely. It's always going to be repeating itself. And that is not the international standard of what has worked in ending poverty and all the ravages of that infant mortality and cholera and all these things. What ended those things always everywhere and in every context has been a government that exists neutrally, as neutrally as it can, that does not pick sides between citizens and foreigners even, a government that creates an environment in which people and as individuals can flourish, where individuals take responsibility for themselves, their families, and their communities, and where the government, which is necessarily and always unqualified to make decisions on behalf of market actors, takes a respectful and a deferent step back and says, even though we as the robed, high and mighty sages who know everything disagree with what you are doing and saying, we will do nothing to stop you. We will not interfere with what people are doing to help themselves. Because as it turns out, much to my shock and my surprise, when you leave people alone, they tend to do things that lift themselves up, that create prosperity for themselves, that create prosperity for their families. That is what people tend to do because people don't like suffering. But when you as a government intervene and say, I'm going to help you solve this, or I am going to solve this for you, which is worse, you take that power entirely away from them and you fail and you fail again and you will always fail. Everyone knows at this stage about South Africa's electricity crisis. We centralized electricity many decades ago. It went well for a few years, but always built into that decision to centralize electricity was the single point of failure that is Eskom, our public power utility, that was built in from the very start. And anyone who understands the spontaneous order, the complex system nature of the economy and of society would have told you this is bad. You can't do not centralize all electricity in this one institution. And now we live with the consequences of that. And it all comes back to the very simple principle that government and politics and political committees and politburos are never qualified. They can never be qualified to make economic decisions, to make resource allocations on behalf of millions of individuals, on behalf of hundreds of thousands of families, on behalf of tens of thousands of communities. It simply cannot, even if it has all the data and resources at its disposal. It should not have the hubris to suppose that it can command and control an economy in this way. It always ends up in disaster.
Well, of course, because there's human beings are human beings and they're motivated by things. And that's just a reality. Mm-hmm. And the socialists don't want to accept that or they want to ignore mm-hmm. that. You know, the profit motive is a good motive because profit motive mm-hmm. spurs innovation. You want to be better than your competitor. There was a comment here about, you know, corporate companies doing business with ANC. That's not capitalism. That's crony capitalism. That's not legitimate capitalism. Free markets regulate themselves. There's a super chat there. Let me address that very quickly from Nick Groves, and then I'll come back to my point. Thank you for that, Nick. It's Marxist-Leninist without the good intention. Collectivism is slow grab nationalism. Collectivism, rising costs. This is impartial. He's immaterial of race. Race laws are a distraction, his 2 cents worth. Yeah, the race laws are a distraction because they think it appeals to a constituency that's poorly informed, thinking by conferring advantage on them based on their skin pigmentation means that the ANC cares about them when it doesn't. The only thing the ANC cares about is caters. And patronage. That's it. Which ironically is very similar to the National Party. But we'll get back to that. They also like nationalized companies too. But so what you're basically saying, Martin, let me just synopsize this for the audience, is that in the beginning, there was no government. There was Adam and Eve. Okay. And at some point, there were enough humans together in bands walking around, you know, presumably on the African savannah somewhere in East Africa, being chased by leopards or their forebears. And they said, hey, listen, you know what? We need to band together to take care of our collective interests, like defense, to protect us. But we'll take care of our own affairs inside, other than that. So the idea is that government takes care of the collective needs, and those needs are not, you know, putting electricity on your table. It's defending you against attack from someone else, that sort of thing. And that small government is better government, because the smaller government is, the less it intrudes in your life, the less liberty it seeks to take from you. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Yeah, okay. that's basically what I'm saying. So government is incompetent at doing 9 out of 10 things. The one thing government is good at is coercion. That is what a government is always good at, and that's good. That's what we want the government to do. We established government specifically to coerce. We want government to protect people using violence, because it protects people from violence with violence. Government is good in coercion. Now, at some point, unfortunately, a worldwide phenomenon, people said, well, listen, we have this thing that is good at coercing, and we have all these other values that we have that we think are good. Why don't we use this violence, this centralization of coercion, to attain these values? And that is probably one of humanity's absolutely worst missteps that it has ever made. Because once that door was opened, it became effectively a free-for-all. Then you have Nazi, you have Holocausts, you have the Holodomor, you have the Great Leap Forward, you have the Anglo-Saxon
cultural revolution, you have Pol Pot, yes. You have all that.
Yeah, yeah, but even before that, you have kings just riding through villages, killing everyone. For no reason of defense,
but
it's
could.
Because at some point, yes, yeah, it's because at some point humanity at a collective level said, we are going to use this defensive violence that government is good at, and we're going to turn it around into an offensive violence, mm-hmm. and we're going to use that to attain things that we like, that we value. That is wrong. Now, I'm very much a radical, what the Americans would call a libertarian in this respect, and that is that the government needs to be concerned with one thing and one thing only, and that is to use its violence to defend people's liberty and their property. Nothing outside of those four corners, even no matter how important that thing might be, and I might agree that, my goodness, prostitution is an ill. It's a terrible thing in society. It's a scourge. Pornography, it poisons the minds of young men. Drugs breaks families apart. It's terrible. We need to pull out all the stops to solve that. But the moment we think that these things are so important that we're going to use the state to fight that battle, we necessarily open the door for it to do other things that threaten our vital interests. It's never just going to be the one issue that you value. You are giving the government power to take care of that one issue, but it's not only taking that power for that one issue. It is taking a comprehensive power that you will, or you or your descendants will, suffer from. And that is why, as classical liberals, as libertarians, as constitutionalists, our role in advocacy and in activism needs to be, we need to put government back in a box. And I think South Africa, given how bad things really are going as a result of government, is a good case study for really how bad it can get, and for how important it is to get this government back in a box, and then hopefully other governments around the world could take that good example as well.
Well, basically what we're saying here is that government needs to be constrained. And that was kind of the concept behind our founding documents, the Federalist Papers and the Anti-Federalist Papers, the Declaration of Independence. You know, when a monarch becomes, you know, a tyrant, you know, the bonds that tie you together should be separated. And that's what we said. That's what we did. It wasn't easy, but we pulled it off. And then our Constitution, which enshrined rights. And our Constitution, contrary to what most people believe, doesn't give us rights. It constrains our government. It constrains our government. To it, let me just read you from the First Amendment. You might be familiar with this. I don't know how well you know U.S. government, but I'm sure you probably heard it. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, which is because of the Anglican Church, because Henry VIII created the Anglican Church out of the Catholic Church, and the state controlled religion. And so they were co-opted. So Congress shall make no law respecting establishment or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. So if you're a Wiccan, a Muslim, a Jew, a Christian, you can practice your faith and government can't stop it, unless it's a pandemic. But we'll get back to that. Or abridging the freedom of speech or the press or the right of the people to peaceably assemble. These are our inalienable, God-given natural law rights. And our Constitution lays out the government cannot abrogate them, although they're doing that today and we're fighting that. So that's the idea, is to constrain government. But the interesting thing about all of this is that these governments get away with this nonsense. And there's no better example of this, Martin, than I've got to tread carefully here so I don't get a strike. So be careful about what we say. I'll just warn you ahead of time. During the spicy cough event, governments ran rapid over our rights all over the world. In South Africa, arresting a mother sitting on a sidewalk nursing her fussy child who needed to eat and was screaming and sitting down in the sand, not near anybody, then arresting people for not wearing facial coverings, which, you know, we won't get into talking about efficacy because I'll get blocked on this platform. But you get the point. This was government run amok. Government run amok in South Africa, in New Zealand, Australia, and even here in America, where my governor prevented the local car dealer from delivering cars to people who had already bought them before he imposed his illegal, unconstitutional restrictions. So these people had already paid for a car and were making car payments on a car sitting in a lot collecting dust. Now, when you pick up a car on a parking lot, you know, the guys who work there can go out, wipe down everything, shut the car door, leave the key on the front seat. All you have to do is walk up. They see you from a distance. Honey, okay, pick it up, go, and you're gone. You don't come. And they were prohibited from that. Thousands of businesses failed. Same thing in South Africa. But we had so much. This is government run amok. This is what happens when government is not constrained by the polity, by the body politic, by the people themselves. Now I'm starting to sound like a libertarian, but I'm a conservative. But I do have libertarian bent in some respects, but not when it comes to drugs. Okay.
Yeah. So look, those 2 years were probably the wet dream of every central planner and social engineer. In South Africa, it reached really ridiculous levels. So our Minister of Trade and Industry banned the sale of wife beater t-shirts. I'm not sure of the
tank tops. Name. It's the correct tank name tops. Is a tank top. That's South yes. African vernacular I don't care for.
Yeah. And he banned the sale of open-toed sandals.
Open-toed sandals, because we know the big toe is the primary vector for the spicy cough.
This is how specific it got. Open-toed sandals and warm chicken. Warm chicken. You cannot buy warm chicken. You can buy a warm steak. You can buy a warm pork. Warm chicken you cannot buy. Mm-hmm. But open-toed sandals you cannot. Closed-toed shoes you can buy. Children's clothing you could not buy.
Yeah.
Adult clothing you can buy. So it reached these levels. And look,
And they got away with it. They got away with it.
Absolutely. So the good thing is that in South Africa we have huge numbers of non-compliers. This government is totally incompetent. We deployed the army to enforce the circus. I don't know where the troops went, because the one time I saw the military in the streets was when an armored personnel carrier was lying on its roof on the highway.
I think I can tell you where the troops went. The troops went to Pick and Pay and Checkers because they weren't given rations.
That was part of it.
True story.
So at the very least, our government was totally unable to enforce any of it, like none of it anywhere. The enforcement came from the private sector. It came from businesses.
Yeah, and that's what's disgraceful.
Yes, it was a total co-opting of the private sector by the government. And that is kind of a part of the role we as the FMF and Saka Liga and other organizations have to play. And that is to say, listen, a healthy constitutional order, and I'm not only talking now about your written constitution, mm-hmm. the constitution, I'm talking about a constitutional order, must be characterized, yes, by a government that is effective, but also by a private commercial sector that is independent of government, also by a civil society, by professions, by organized religion, all these various organizations in society that are independent of each other, that exercise a controlling check and balance effectively upon each other. Now that during those 2 years during the circus, that did not happen, because churches in South Africa, businesses in South Africa, civil society, we had a good civil society response to this, but then many aspects of civil society just fell in and said, listen, oh my Lord, this is a crisis. We must do whatever the president announces. So we're not going to sell you children's clothing or open-toed sandals anymore. We're going to do what we are told. And that, I mean, as you said, thousands of businesses closed. I think in South Africa, we added a million additional people to the ranks of the unemployed. We have 13.5 million unemployed South Africans.
Well, at one point you had 3.2 million unemployed initially, but a lot of those people came back to work. But no, it's you know, not only do they comply, but they became the oppressors of the state, private sector. Here too. Exactly. It's insane. Absolutely insane what happened there. It's driving me crazy that people have gotten away with this. We're going to get back to the Employment Equity Act here in just a moment. But it's, you know, this is, as you said, kind of the wet dream of the central planners. This is pretty frightening what's happened around the world and what continues to happen. And people just accept this sort of thing until they're in a box. And, you know, it kind of reminds me of, you know, it wasn't Bonhoeffer, but the other cleric in Germany during the 1930s said, you know, first they came for the communists and I said nothing. Then they came for the socialists, said nothing. Then they came for the homosexuals. I wasn't gay, so I didn't say anything. And eventually you keep going. Then they came for me and there was nobody there to defend me. I mean, eventually that's what you get whittled down to. And that's what's the central planners, these leftists, these socialists, these communists are very good at dividing people, race, religion, class. That's the big one now. You know, I see this, then this get back to law here, is that one of the rules coming into effect from the Minister of No Trade and No Development there, Ibrahim Patel, the most useless gas bag on the planet. Well, no, Fikile Mabulula is pretty bad too. But anyway, this clown car show, he's got a rule coming out that says that the corporations must disclose the top 5% of their income earners and the top bottom 5%. What is the purpose of that other than to create class distinction and envy and hatred? There's no value to that whatsoever. Now, if you want to say that top 5% of corporation get, you know, 30% of the revenue that's made, that's a different story. That creates a little bit of class division, but that's transparency. But identifying people and you know, who are getting paychecks just in a show who's getting nothing so you can create hatred. I mean, what's the purpose of that other than what I just said?
Yeah, look, unfortunately, we're heading into election season in South Africa. Next year is our next general election. And this is widely thought to be the first election where the ANC will get fewer than 50% of the vote, less than 50%, even though everyone agrees it's still going to be the largest party with a plurality, but it's no longer going to have that absolute majority anymore. So the ANC is unfortunately taking out all the stops in trying to generate some kind of populist excitement for it. And this is definitely part of that. You say, oh, look, we are the vanguard of the working class, and we're going to identify those filthy capitalists who are profiting off the your surplus value, if you want to use that Marxist term. And now we've identified them, and now we're probably going to put the competition commission or the wage commission on them and then go after them. So yeah, it's unfortunately election season, and now it's time for all the ridiculous things to happen. We're considering nationalizing healthcare now. Everything is back on the agenda now, at least until the next election is over. But yeah, it's every election cycle gets more absurd. And like I said earlier, the moment you no longer conceive of government as something that must at least aspire to be a neutral institution between the various groups in society, classes, races, cultures, whatever. The moment you think government must take sides, you end up with this kind of absurdity, and then you kind of open Pandora's box of government legitimacy. Because with the Employment Equity Act, effectively, I was at a conference today about the act, and one of the speakers effectively said that the ANC government has now closed the door to racial minorities in South Africa. It has basically now said, listen, we do not want you in the economy. We do not want you in the country. We're done with you, with racial minorities, whites, whites, Indians, and coloreds, etc., with this type of law. So the government is actively taking sides, even though its measure is still very detrimental to the side that it is apparently taken, which is the black majority. But the government has closed that door. It has taken a side. And now the question is, to what level can the ANC government claim a legitimate jurisdiction over, at least for now, the racial minorities in South Africa, after it has effectively, in a way, effectively disenfranchised them from the economy? And you just open up so many problems when governments start taking sides. So just rather avoid it, put the government back in that box, let it not take sides, let it create that environment for flourishing for individuals and communities.
Well, that's an accurate, I believe, assessment of what the ANC's done. But the reality is this, is they may not want minorities involved in the economy, and they want them out of the country, but they made it impossible for people to leave. They confiscate your wealth when you leave that you built up. So how can you go penniless elsewhere unless you're destitute and desperate? And beyond that, they criminalized 250,000 minority South Africans, targeting them in the Western Cape while letting people run riot in Alexandria and even the Western Cape in Khayelitsha and places like that after they murdered Collins Cosa. They murdered him. The security forces beat him to death in broad daylight in front of people in a township. And they realized that they would have a mass riot and an insurrection, kind of like they had in July 2021, on their hands if they continued. Yeah. So they pulled back out of those rural areas and out of the townships and let people go about their business while punishing the minority, particularly the white minority in the Western Cape, and giving them criminal records so they can't even migrate out of the country now. And then even if you don't have a criminal record, you can never get a freaking passport because Home Affairs never, I mean, they declared me, almost declared me an undesirable immigrant because a moron wrote the wrong date down in my passport at OR Tambo. I've been in and out of South Africa 450 times in the last 30 years. And that's never happened. But if I had left the country, I would have been banned for 5 years. Are you serious? Are you all the money and investment I brought to South Africa and the things I've done for the, anyway, it's ridiculous, But let me just get back. Let's get to the Employment Equity Act. 2 points here, because we did attract an audience on this, and that's why I should come on. So the Employment Equity Act already exists. This is an amendment that we're talking about now. And there's two things that have come out. The Democratic Alliance and others are criticizing this act amendment for one thing. And then I'll give the Democratic Alliance credit for this. I criticize them frequently, but I do give them their due when they earn it, and they earned it here. They noted something in the regulations related to water usage, and that has now come. It's finally made it into the press, but they identified that about 3 weeks ago. So according to my understanding of the Employment Equity Act, based on what I've read from the act, the amendment, and also this water thing, number one, I want you to address these 2 points. Number one, the DA and others are claiming that this would cap the percentage of employees in senior management and mid-level management, I believe, at like 4.9% for white males and 4.6% for white females. And then based on province, some provinces like in Limpopo, no colored managers could be hired, and Mpumalanga, things like that. So basically it's suppressing and limiting the number of minority, white, Indian, and colored applicants or employees. I mean, you're private, and this is in the private sector. This isn't government employment. This is in the private. So if I start a company, they're going to tell me I can't hire this guy. If I can't hire Elon Musk as my CEO because he's white, that's ludicrous. And it's also inhumane. It's a clear violation of the Human Rights Declaration, of which South Africa is a signatory. There's no force of law behind that, but it is an aspirational document. And it's a violation of South Africa's constitution. Clearly it's unconstitutional. So there's that. Then this part about, well, you know, if you don't have black ownership, you can't get a certain amount of water if you're over a certain size. And this is going to have an absolutely eviscerating effect, devastating impact on the agricultural sector. And not just that, but on that particular, farms will shut down and they'll just be left destitute. They'll lay fallow and South Africans will start to go hungry. Well, that is until the United States starts shipping free food aid there, because, you know, we'll do that. The white liberal guilt's coming on. Okay, so am I right about this, you know, quotas for minorities in employment? And am I also correct about they're trying to limit water usage by minorities, particularly white South Africans?
Yeah, so on that first point, it gets even more granular than saying only at the upper levels. So the Amendment Act allows the minister to set... they call it targets, but I think we should call them quotas.
Oh, it's a target, all right. It's a target.
Yeah, it's a target on the back of productive, hardworking, ordinary South Africans on the basis of race, gender, disability. And it may be in the context of a province, a economic sector, and occupational levels. So senior management, middle management, lower management, and even just the skilled employees and the unskilled employees of a business may be subject to its own targets. The sector, so the insurance sector, the mining sector, what have you, anything, the tourism sector, and then for different provinces as well. It gets very granular, and the minister has published these regulations to say for each of these things. So we have, for instance, a target for black women in the Free State, in the hairdressing sector, in middle management. We have stuff like that, and that would say it may only be 0.4% white, it may be 1.2% Indian, it may be 3.4% colored, which is mixed race, and it must be 80.4% black. It gets that granular. But I mean, it gets so so absurd that in one province, in Limpopo, effectively all four race groups, so South Africa is formally kind of divided into black, white, colored, and Indian, will be detrimentally affected. So there must be fewer employed whites, fewer employed coloreds, fewer employed Indians, and fewer employed blacks in general, simply because in the black category, black women are overrepresented. So therefore, a bunch of black men have to be fired. A bunch of black women have to be fired.
So people will have to be fired in the private sector who are working productively now simply to meet a government-imposed socialist fascist quota.
So the terrible and the funny thing here is that the government says, oh no, we're not asking anyone to be fired, but you're kind of have to grow into those numbers. So for a company to without replacing existing productive employees to attain these targets that the minister has set, it would need the agricultural industry. I think I heard from this conference earlier would need to be, I think, something like 66 times bigger than it currently is for it to grow into the target so that it doesn't fire
insane.
Anyone.
Absolutely,
so it's impossible. It's totally impossible.
Well,
the only way to comply would be to fire people.
Fire people. Let me give you an example, and this is the South African example, just how absurd all of this is, okay? This is so absurd. So folks, for those around the world, not in the Anglo-Saxon world, minus US and Canada, because they've got this in Australia, New Zealand, and in the UK, netball is a very popular game for high school girls. They play it. It's kind of a weird game. It's like basketball with a tiny little hoop and you can't dribble. You have to stop and stand. It's a weird game, but it's kind of interesting to watch. Anyway, but netball is very popular and it's actually a professional sport. Women can make a living from it in the United Kingdom and in Australia. They go out there. So a couple of years ago, in the height of this lunacy with the lockdown, the netball championship was on and a team won. They were ecstatic. They're jumping up and down. And the game was forfeited because they didn't have enough white players on the court at one stage for over 3 minutes. One of the players was injured and they didn't have another white player. And so they put a black player out there to play the game. They won the game and the Netball Association abrogated their victory. An incredible game. I actually watched the game. I don't know why I was watching, but I watched the game. It was incredible. And they abrogated the victory, took it away because not enough white women were on the court. This is insane. If that were the case, the NBA would have to shut down. It's 78% black. They're only 12% of the population. You'd have to shut down the National Basketball Association. I mean, this is absolutely ludicrous. Now, the impact of that is that the black and white girls on the team that should have gone to, this was the semifinal, should have gone to the final and had an opportunity to be in front of cameras and get scouts and get scholarships at university or go and be recruited in professional leagues, never got that opportunity because of race-based lunacy. And that's what we're talking about. That's what's going to happen in the employment sector in South Africa.
No, exactly that. And I mean, the other thing is for Indians in certain areas, for instance, if you're only allowed to have 0.1% Indians at upper management level, you're going to have to appoint 1,000 Indians at your upper management level before you can promote one of them. So it represents not only a bar on employment of new people, but it also represents a bar on promotions. And perversely, it also represents a bar on demotions. You're not allowed to demote.
Yeah, because you'll skew the numbers if you bump somebody down.
Exactly. The whole thing is absurd. And I mean, I've actually given up trying to understand many of its intricacies because there's no point. It's designed to be like this. But on your second question on water. So
before we get to the water, it's actually Orwellian is what it is. You know, George Orwell couldn't come up with this lunacy, but a couple things in the chat really quickly here. The first one here is that someone named Breibrookies is here. Now I'm hungry. Where'd you come in with that username? You made me hungry. And then I have to thank Cameron, who said very politely, he said, first to go is electricity, then water, then the economy. Chris has said this often. Thank you for that recognition. People forget that I've been pointing this out. Speaking of which, we started to talk about the land expropriation without compensation. I did want to get back to that point. Let me get to that. We'll come back to the water, okay, because I don't want to forget this. I've just put a link in to an article that I wrote, 4 years ago, going on 5 years ago now, about land and poverty in South Africa. You know, we were talking about, you know, blaming Jan van Riebeck and apartheid and Hendrik Verwoerd and, you know, the Xhosa and the Zulu and Mfokane and all that stuff. There was, I thought, I want your take on this. That's why I'm asking. I thought it was a very prudent decision taken at CODESA, the Convention for Democratic South Africa in the early 1990s. One of the few things I think they got right is that they said, listen, we are going to consider land claims back to 1910. Now, the reason I thought that was a pragmatic decision is that in 1994, there are actually people who were born before 1910 and who were alive at that time who were impacted by this directly, and that there was no South Africa prior to 1910. It was colonies, kingdoms, empires, all sorts of things. You got the Orange Free State, the Transvaal Republic, you know, you've got the Zulu Kingdom and so on and so forth. In 1910, the Union South Africa Act by the British Parliament established South Africa. Now, it became a, you know, a country technically in 1961, but that's another story. But anyway, that established it. So I thought it was reasonable to go back. And then anyone with a land claim, it didn't even have to be you. It could have been your parents or your grandparents because that was the time frame. I thought that was very pragmatic. But now we have lunacy of people like Julius Malema running around and going, oh, they stole the land from us in 1840. Well, you stole the land from the Khoisan in 1620. You know, come on, grow up. You know, you have to take a starting point. What do you think? Do you think that was a pragmatic decision to say we can accept land claims back to 1910, or should it start at 1948, or should they just ignore it altogether? I know you won't agree to the last point. I'm just throwing it out there as a non sequitur.
So the actual date is 1913. That's when the Natives Land Act was adopted. That is
right. Yeah, 1913. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So it was.
But 1910. My point is shouldn't be. No, there should be no starting point before 1910.
So look, I think I have a slightly different take on that. For me, as someone who I guess I'm a little bit dogmatic about my libertarianism, my liberal property view, and that is many of your listeners might have heard of a guy called Murray Rothbard, and he effectively made an argument that I kind of buy into, and that is that if property is stolen from someone, at no point does that property rightfully become the thief's property. Now, that title passes down the generations, and at all points that property can be claimed back. Now, that's the principle, and I agree with that. I think that if someone took property in 1680 after whites arrived in South Africa, and someone today can go to our land claims court and say that property over there, that defined piece of land between these points, I can prove that that belonged to my great 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 grandparent, and I can prove my entitlement to that property. My argument would be, yes, you should be able to get that land back, because that the person currently there can never be the rightful owner of it. But here is the big proviso, and this is where myself and Mr. Malema totally diverge. The current owner of that property is not guilty of anything.
Correct.
That person did not do anything wrong other than buy the property at some point or inherited the property.
Yes.
This person is perfectly innocent. And government is, and expropriation specifically, but government is not an institution of vengeance. Government is not there to exact revenge.
It's not. Blood, that's what the ANC seems to be all about, vengeance.
Yeah, it is, but it shouldn't be that way.
Right.
And this person who innocently owns this property that is not rightly theirs must be compensated. It must be well compensated for that property. Ultimately, the person claiming the property, if they can prove a true title, must receive that property back if they want it. Otherwise, they must be compensated for the loss to their family. But the innocent current possessor of the property must be well compensated for the loss, because they did nothing wrong. They probably bought that property at great expense. They've probably invested greatly into that property, not only financially, but also emotionally and in sentiment. They must be very handsomely compensated for giving up that property. So I agree that there must be a land claims process as a matter of justice. And I mean, our legal system, the Roman Dutch common law, recognizes that, listen, you have to be able to claim property back. I'm in principle all in favor of that. But what these communists, these violent authoritarians are doing is they're saying the fact that the owner of that property has a white skin makes them guilty of a blood crime. They must receive not a cent for that property, and that property must not go to someone who has proven that that property belongs to them. It must simply go to some black person, maybe, but actually to the government. It must be nationalized. So that is evil. That is totally
well, and it even gets nonsensical justice. From a standpoint, Martin, that land that has been given in restitution to Black claimants in South Africa has then been subsequently sold, which is their right to do, to yeah. white people. And then someone comes exactly. back and says, well, you're white. You have to give it back again. This is ludicrous. Ridiculous. So, listen, here's the thing. This is where libertarians and I part company. People may not like it, but the world is governed by the Westphalian system of states. It's not a formal system, but since 1648, the Peace of Westphalia, when we ended a horrible 30-year conflict over religion, Christianity, Protestantism, and Catholicism, the world has been governed by the Westphalian system of states. First Europe, and then the world by greater extension. Conquest is a legitimate act. Taking land and resources by conquest is legitimate. It may not be morally right, but it is legally accepted and among states. That's the interaction between states. That's reality. If it wasn't, then Silesia belongs to Germans. Then Pomerania belongs to Germans. Preussen belongs to Germans. And two-thirds of the Baltic states belong to ethnic Germans. And they should claim them today because they were illegitimately stolen from them in 1945. We're talking 13 million Germans were evicted, most of whom had nothing to do with the Nazis. They were just caught in a system that did nothing to oppress anybody. They suffered as well, and they were chased, and 4 million of them were killed and murdered by Soviets with strafing runs by aircraft, starved to death, murdered on trains, raped, gang raped coming from by Poles and by Czechs. So it gets silly at some point, but conquest is legitimate. So I'm not thrilled with German ancestors who were from the East, who lost their land, but it's over. It's done. And that's why there has to be a starting point. And that's why I don't agree that's legitimate to go back. I don't think it's fair for Grafen Donin to go back and say, my estate in Marienburg there, which is Kaliningrad area today, that's mine and I want it back because you lost the war. You lost the war. Maybe not you, but your country lost the war. And that's reality. I mean, the six Boer Kosa wars weren't started by the Boers. Some were, and some were started by the Kosa. You know, the Zulu. And so this is where I part company. I mean, it may sound unpalatable to people, but conquest is a legitimate means of acquisition. Sorry, that's where I'm at. Anyway, that's where we part company. Anyway,
that's fair enough.
Fair enough. Okay, so, but see, we can have a cogent conversation and disagree. I love it. It's unlike these leftist hate wankers. Anyway, but back to the water thing now. Okay, let's go to that. I'll give you a chance to answer that question. What's going on with that? Because that sounds very detrimental to the safety, the security, the employment, the wealth and prosperity of all South Africans.
These people are totally insane. Like,
yeah, I agree.
It kind of came out of nowhere that South Africa is a relatively dry country.
Only 13% of the land is arable. Let's remember that.
Yeah. Yeah. And we don't have huge hydro dams and anything. We really struggle with water in South Africa.
If it wasn't for Lesotho, you'd all be dead.
Yeah.
Except in the Western Cape.
But nonetheless, South African agriculture is quite internationally competitive. It's been a bedrock of our economy for many years, for centuries. Now the Minister of Water and Fisheries or something published these regulations. Now, it's not part of the Employment Equity Act. This is something that has to do with broad-based Black economic empowerment, which has to do with ownership. And he basically said, now remember I said earlier that the South African government nationalized water in 1998. All water in South Africa falls under the so-called custodianship of the state. Now, custodianship is just a coded language for the state as the owner. And effectively, you may have water on your property as a farmer. You still need a license to use that from the government. And now we are in the situation where these regulations say that unless you, as a commercial farmer or whatever other kind of business you're running that has to do with water, unless your shareholding is 75% Black, you will, I'm speaking under correction here, I'm not sure. I don't know if you're being totally disqualified from acquiring the rights, but at least you're kind of being going down on the rungs there. You're kind of being put at a disadvantage there. Now, organized agriculture in South Africa has already said, listen, if this is implemented, then South African agriculture, which granted, of course, is still largely white, is going to grind to a halt. It's done. It's over. It's over. Food security in South Africa is done for if these regulations are adopted. Because in this dry country where the rain is not an independent source of water, farmers need huge amounts of water, and farmers in South Africa are still by and large a white community. So very few people, very few commercial farms are going to qualify under these regulations. And I'm not entirely sure what the legal implications of that are, but it's going to be bad for South African agriculture. And it's absolutely astoundingly ridiculous, because the major, the government approaches this almost in the sense of, gotcha, got you white farmers. It's like, okay, fair enough. Great. So he's now going to go out of business, the white farmer, head low, packs his bags, damn it, he moves to Botswana, or he moves to Zambia, or he moves to Angola, and he goes and buys a little farm there, and he goes and farms there. The people who are going to be most disadvantaged by this absolute tripe are poor South Africans who can already not afford many things, but now we are just going to have a shortage of food. So what? Is this a spite against the white agricultural community really worth creating a humanitarian crisis amongst a majority black population? Is that really the type of thinking that we see at the very upper echelon of the South African government?
Yes,
it is absolutely that ridiculous is the thinking. That is the case. Yeah, I mean,
what's so frustrating about this? It is unbelievable. It's gobsmacking and it's ignorance and stupidity. What's really amazing about this is what the ANC said 4 or 5 years ago. They want to put 1 million black farmers on farms. The rest of the world is automating agriculture. We're reducing the agricultural workforce everywhere in the world, including places like Iraq and Iran. This is absolute insanity. The path to prosperity, wealth, and a better life is not farming. It is for farmers and large industrial farmers. They can make a living. It can be profitable, but they still deal with the vicissitudes of weather and commodity prices and pestilence and all this other stuff. Never mind what governments and conflict do to them. So farming is not the answer. The answer is to actually educate South Africans properly into basic skills like literacy and mathematics. Excuse me. They're talking about being a hub of AI, artificial intelligence and robotics. You can't even freaking let kids go to the toilet. They're using pit latrines, and six-year-olds are suffocating in human feces in the Eastern Cape, and corrupt BE companies are stealing the money from textbook tenders and never delivering textbooks to school children. This is absolutely batshit crazy nonsense. And the fact that the world doesn't even see it pisses me off to no end, Martin. I think you're getting that impression now from my reaction here. This is lunacy of the highest order. It is time for South Africans to band together to stop this nonsense, whether it's the IRR, it's a free market foundation, it's AfriForum, it's whatever. You all need to get off your bum and get together. And those of you who just avoid the state and ignore the state, you're not helping. You're taking care of your personal situation, but that's an individual basis. South Africans, black, white, and brown, this system oppresses all of you. Every single one of you. Sorry, I had to interject, Martin. I couldn't hold that back any longer.
No, please feel free. Look, this is one of the myths that the ANC has been very effective in generating and selling, not only to South Africa, but to the world. And that is that there is this mass of black South Africans who have what they call a hunger for land.
No, and they want residential land for their homes, not farms.
So the ANC will look far and wide, and it will not find a million black South Africans to go and farm. Not because they're unqualified or stupid or whatever, but
farming sucks. It sucks. I've been a farmer. 5 o'clock every morning, milking cows. I got to be up at 4 o'clock to milk cows. 7 days a week, no holidays. It sucks, farming, man.
Farming is a passion that you pick up from family ties, and that's great, and that's fine, and those farmers must be cherished and protected. But it's it's very ridiculous. But black South Africans during this land claims process that we have discussed, by and large, the huge majority of land claims that succeeded, where black South Africans were able to prove in court that this land belongs to me rightly in title. It was taken after 1913, and it is my land. They proved that. The court said, you've proved it.
Most of those people took money instead of the land.
Exactly. They get a choice in terms of the Restitution of Land Rights Act. You can choose to get the land back, or you can get compensated. The vast majority of black South Africans, or whoever else, where it's a non-racial process, if you're a white claimant, whatever, most people chose money. Yes. Why is there this? I mean, we're all okay. Well, many of us are familiar with the Marxist romanticization of agrarianism. The Industrial Revolution interrupted humanity's relationship with the land, and it kind of pushed people into the cities and created squalor, and it's terrible. And we need to get
playing
people
a
back
violin.
To the land.
I'm
yes
playing a violin.
yeah exactly I mean it's this romanticization of the agrarian economy when
yeah.
South Africa has industrialized. We're an industrial economy. The people here do not have to be poor. We have
No.
all the infrastructure to be a wealthy, service-based, tertiary economy.
And
But
the
the
resources,
government,
not just the infrastructure, the resources too.
Yes, exactly. But the government is with Marxist-Leninist roots is still wedded to this idea that, ooh, there's this hunger for land. The land is the answer. The land is the basis of everything. And we need to get Black South Africans back on farms. Black South Africans, white South Africans, colored and Indian South Africans do not want to farm.
Well, but even if
we take
the premise of putting 1 million black South Africans back on the farm, what about the other 42 million?
Yeah.
What about the other 42 million? What is that going to do for them? You know, they're not going to go work for the other farmers. Give me a break. It's ridiculous.
And repeated surveys by the Institute of Race Relations have shown that that land reform and racism and inequality and black ownership for black South Africans, these are not big issues. These are not the most important issues.
But you wouldn't know that, Martin, from the media, from News 24, IOL, Rapport. No. That's all they talk about. And this whole process has been polluted and distorted by Jacob Zuma. And I'm going to come to that. So the land claims process started, you can make a claim in 1995 to 1999, a five-year window. You can make your claim back to, as you said, 1913. So there were 75,000 land claims filed by South Africans, and many of them filed by people who weren't even alive then. Most, in fact, they weren't, it wasn't their property. It was taken from their parents or grandparents. So they filed it. It was legitimate. That was the process they came up with. 73,000 of those claims were settled by the early part of the odd decade, less than a decade later. The remainder of them were contentious because there were multiple claimants and they were trying to sort it out. I don't know the status of that now because I never get updates from the lands ministry. But so then Zuma reopened another window and 141,000 additional claims came in. The vast majority of them fraudulent claims or dishonest claims that have taken forever and they bogged it down. And on top of that, the lands ministry provides no extension services to new farmers. It provides no capital, no training. It does nothing to help them. In fact, commercial white farmers have done demonstrably more for new commercial black farmers, helping them get set up, providing grants and loans and technical assistance, water and resources. And it's never reported on. Because farmers, while they're in competition, they all have something to benefit if farmers are successful. You don't need your neighbor failing, you know, because the pestilence that shows up on his farm could be on your farm because he didn't take care of his farm properly. So there's a communal value in this. It just really irritates the heck out of me that this whole process become polluted. And then the other piece of this polluted this, besides the media and the politicians, was the hiving off of Juju and his little economic, you know, fools, economic freedom fighters in the red prison jumpsuits. They start taking up and championing this expropriation. And when nobody wants expropriation, except these politicians.
Yeah. Now, look, it's an entirely, I think the correct word is red herring.
That's correct. Red herring.
If you go to poor communities, people there have generally, I would say, three biggest issues. That is unemployment. They want jobs, of course. And the other one is education. They want their children to go to high quality schools, which they aren't. And number three, crime. South Africa has one of the highest violent crime rates in the world amongst countries that kind of keep good records. Those are the three issues: unemployment, education, violent crime. At the very lowest rung on that list is land redistribution, racism, and income inequality. These things nobody cares about, but it gets crowds riled up. It gets a specific crowd of people out onto the streets and chanting, "We want land or death or whatever." And the politicians know that it's exciting. It's something tangible. It's something very tangible that they can play with, something that they can manipulate. Whereas unemployment, You actually have to implement a free market system to create employment. So no one is going to touch that, even though that would be the winning topic by far during an election. Yeah, you need a free market if you want employment. To address crime in South Africa, unfortunately, quite a few fundamental things need to change, which the
criminal justice system, forensics, law enforcement. I mean, it's a whole list of things. Yeah,
but land is easy. So they can't fix education because the SATU, the trade union in education, is very politically influential. So they're not going to touch education. No one is going to fix education from government's perspective. It's not going to happen because SATU would grind everything to a halt and would damage the ANC very much. Never going to touch education. Never going to touch criminal justice. Never going to touch employment. They're going to go for the easy things. Racism is easy. It's an accusation. You don't need proof. You just say you're racist. The media gobbles it up. It's exciting. Mm-hmm. Land is easy. You don't need to actually do anything. Up until very recently, the land claims court only had one permanent judge. Land reform gets less, I think, than 5% of national funding in the budget. The government doesn't care about
that. No, there's no money. You look at the budget they spent more money on mask for that ministry than they did for land. Yes. They did. It's true.
Yes.
It's true. Because I brought that out during the lockdown. It's absolutely crazy. You know, I mean, look, and the distortions by media, particularly around the world, are really annoying. Mm. Vox, a hard left media site, did a video talking about spatial apartheid in South Africa in 2021 or whatever it was, 2022. Yeah. And I watched that disgusting, vile thing. Well, South Africa's apartheid continues. Look at how unfair and unjust it is. I'm like, stop. The reason those people living in the Western Cape in townships right adjacent to leafy suburbs, you know, across the highway, the reason they live in those conditions is because of the macroeconomic decisions made by this government, which have impinged and impoverished millions of Black South Africans and give them no hope. Most of those people living in that township aren't even from Khayelitsha. They're from the Eastern Cape, and they moved there. There was only 30,000, 50,000 people living in the Cape Flats 30 years ago. Now there's 800,000 because they came there for hope. And they come there, and they're hampered from making money and moving up the rung by government decisions, by lawlessness, by no electricity, by idiocy going on by this government. And Vox is completely dishonest. And here's the thing. They're implying to the sheep who don't know better that, well, this is because the whites control things. No, anybody can move in that neighborhood. You can buy a house. There's no law stopping you from that. Exactly. In fact, look at the wealthiest suburb right behind Santa City there. I forget the name of it there. I drove through it for the first time. I've been to Santa a million times, but my GPS took me from where I was coming. And I'm like, whoa, look at these 15-foot walls and Bentleys and BMWs and in like nine cars. And these people have tens of millions, billions or hundred, you know, millions of dollars of wealth. They're all Black. They're all Black because they're tied to the ANC. They're all part of the Cadres. They've been given shares, this, that, and the other. People can live where they want to live. They're not prohibited. And Vox putting this out there and the South African government media implying that people are being held back by racism are full of it. Well, they are being held back by racism, but it's the inverse. It's the minorities being held back by racism. And then by greater extension, the entire population are being held back by this racist laws. But it's not going to change until the ANC's vote out of office. And they're not going to be able to out of office if y'all sit on your ass and don't get out and register and vote in 2024. Yeah. I'm sick of telling South Africans this. I said 2021 was a chance to change things and almost nobody listened. Back when I actually had a real big audience, but people didn't listen. They didn't go vote. Oh, yeah, it's not going to change. Well, guess what? Nothing changed. You don't vote. But here's the thing. In KwaZulu-Natal, because of the 2021 riots or insurrection, internal ANC insurrection that took place, ANC voters didn't show up. The IFP only gained 2% more voters, yet they went from 7 municipalities it controlled to 16, either outright through a coalition, majority coalition, or minority coalition. So the IFP controls 16 cities in KZN, which is double what they had before, simply because ANC didn't show up. Imagine if all the people support the IFP and support the DA and other parties actually went out and voted, the ANC would control virtually nothing in KwaZulu-Natal. You could change life overnight. Now, I understand that some competencies are controlled by the national government, but you can fix a lot of things, and it's service delivery at the local level that people see. 2024, if you don't go vote, you are part of South Africa's problem. I'm sorry, that's case closed.
No, I agree. Yeah, just 2 points on that. The first is that the Black middle class and upper class is larger than the entire white population. So to ever like try and imply that there is spatial apartheid, and if you see a nice house, it's white, and if you see a shack, it's Black. Yes, the chances that the shack is Black is true, but there's the the house is not necessarily white. That myth needs to die. The black middle and upper class is larger than the entire white population. These people do not live in shacks. You don't live in a shack if you're middle and upper class. They live in leafy suburbs, side by side with whites and Indians and coloreds. Yes, the bulk of poor South Africans remains black, and as you rightly say, that is largely due to this government not adopting sensible policy after 1994 on the elections. So this is something that that frustrates me with many of my fellow South Africans, and that is that they say the ANC is kept in power by the majority, by black South Africans, but
no, it's not
generally
true.
In the majority. The ANC is a minority government.
Yeah.
The ANC attracted a minority of the votes of the registered electorate.
13% exactly. of the eligible voters voted in municipal elections. That is not even remotely a mandate for anything. Only 13% of eligible voters voted ANC, 8.5 million people in this last election.
Exactly. Yeah. And even in the previous national election, the ANC did not attract an absolute majority of South African voters to vote for them. So amongst people who voted, yes, they got a majority, but that is not a mandate in my view. And you can hardly claim that if you see a poor South African or a black South African or whatever on the side of the road, it's impossible to say that that person is responsible for their own poverty because they voted ANC. You can simply not claim that anymore. And as you rightly say, the opposition is benefiting immensely by ANC voters staying home. Now, one of the issues is that the opposition doesn't really have a good sell to get the electorate energized.
Agree.
They're kind of mishandling that, but they are benefiting by ANC voters who are saying, "Listen, I don't like you opposition voters, but I am hell of a not gonna vote for the ANC again. I am staying home." That is where the big changes are. But yes, of course, we would much rather have a very clear rejection of the ANC at the ballot box. And really not just the ANC, but any political party that believes, and there are many in South Africa, that believes that it's government's job to kind of create prosperity rather than creating the environment for people.
Just the conditions. So, the government's job is to create conditions and be there as a neutral arbiter to ensure that people don't take unfair advantage, like monopolies and like people who swindle people. They're there to be the arbiter. That's the purpose of government, not to pick winners and losers. And that's what these governments do here in America. There, you know, the whole 2008 financial crisis was created by the government. They blame banks. But it was the government that created the conditions with the Community Reinvestment Act, which forced banks to lend money to people who weren't creditworthy based on their skin pigmentation, which created the subprime crisis. And then there's a whole list of other things the government did that created this crisis. And we nearly destroyed the entire financial system, which is what they're trying to do now. But that's a whole other story. We'll discuss that on another day. But Martin, this is fascinating. And we've got a big audience right now. I'd love to stay, but I've had you for an hour and a half. That's very generous of your time for our first time to chat. And it's a pleasure to actually chat with you now that we only had a brief moment to speak at the film preview or premiere. So thank you for that. I'm going to give you a chance to have any last words you want to share about this Employment Equity Act or about South Africa, or maybe encourage people to vote next year or something. But let me give you the floor here, and then I'll have you drop off, and then I'll wrap up. Okay.
Okay. Yeah, perfect. So just I think as a general parting remark, if you're a foreigner, please take things that come out of South Africa with a tinge of salt. Our history is very well publicized. Our apartheid history is very, very well known, very well publicized. I'm sure most of that is true, but understand that much has happened in the last 30 years. In the main, white South Africans are not these evil racists trying to repress blacks. That's simply not the case anymore. And even if they were, even if we were, we have absolutely no way of enacting any such thing, such plan, if such a plan existed. There is no way. It's not true. White South Africans and most black South Africans have taken arms and said, "Listen, we want to work together to live together. We want to work together, and we want to prosper together in South Africa as equal citizens." Unfortunately, what this government sells to the international media and what our media sells to international media is a very different story. So please, if you're interested in South Africa, look at organizations like the Free Market Foundation, the Institute of Race Relations, which was an anti-apartheid organization for 70 odd years. It can hardly be blamed for being a pro-white supremacist organization. And look at AfriForum and all these organizations. Look at what they say about something happening in South Africa before you form an opinion. Just for that balance. That's for your foreign audience. For locals, yes, please. We are in quite a terrible economic time, but quite a positive political time. The potential for the ANC and its coalition of corruption, along with the EFF and various other parties, to actually be voted out of government. If it's not going to happen next year, it's certainly going to happen in 2029. And everyone has a role to play in that. If you're not politically inclined, at least get involved with your local community. Start plugging the holes left by collapsing local services. Start providing services to your community. And so on. And of course, put up solar panels and so on to end the electricity crisis for yourself. But yeah, that's basically it. Just finally, if you are interested in following my work, I have a website. That's martinvanstaden.com. You can also follow me on Twitter @martin_ASFL. And yes, I'm very active on that platform. And yes, if you have enjoyed what I've had to say and you think I'm mostly credible, please feel free to follow me, and I provide a running commentary on whatever is happening in South Africa. And thank you very much, Chris. I've really enjoyed this hour and a half, and let's do it again.
Yeah, absolutely. Whoa. Yeah, stole my thunder. I was going to invite you back. Now you're not welcome back. No, I'm just kidding. No, it was a pleasure. I really did enjoy it. That's the thing about this. You know, I mean, and people know, have been with my channel for a long time. Got to be careful, because I've done 3, 4, 5, 7, 13-hour broadcasts before. They're not going to do that today. But thank you so much for that. There was a question here, and it was from Bri Broiki. So let me find where that's at here. Let me see if I can do this well enough for Hans. Martin, va kom jy vandaan? I think he's asking where you're from. It doesn't sound like you're a Kapsa boy there. Where are you from? Do you mind sharing that, or is that a state secret?
No. I was born in Vereeniging, but I do understand that I do not have your typical Afrikaans English accent. Maar ek is totale Afrikaner. Ek het groot geword in Afrikaans. Dit is my huistaal. But I've kind of Americanized my accent to a large degree when I... for many years, I thought I was going to immigrate to the United States, and kind of this is what's left, which is kind of a Dutch Swedish kind of hybrid.
Is kind of a Dutch Swedish hybrid. That's a good description.
But yeah, that's the story there.
Okay, yeah, there you go. So he's a real South African. And Bri Broiki says, Mui. Okay. All right. Well, Martin van Staden, bye bye, donkey. Thank you very much for your time. I really enjoyed it. We will do this again. And thanks for the conversation. I enjoyed the things we agreed on and the small things we slightly disagree on. Those are talking points and starting points. Have a lovely evening, and we'll catch you later. I'll let you drop off here.
You too. Cheerio.